Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on KOOP. We originate on KOOP 91.7 FM, KOOP.org in Austin, Texas. We are an all-volunteer, cooperatively run, solar-powered community radio station. We're rebroadcast on a number of other stations around the country, public radio stations, community radio stations, and our podcasts are posted a bunch of places. So we have a national following. And we welcome everybody to the show one more time. We have a great guest today, Robert Cottrell, who's an author, a cultural historian, and has written about stuff that we here have either been interested in or have lived through. That's as far as I'm concerned, the live-through part. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Susie Sheeler is our associate. And will also, I think, because she didn't live through any of it, she might pop in with some questions because it's a different perspective. So. All right. Robert Cottrell, I have a problem with that. His book on the counterculture, which is the sex, drugs. His two books are Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. The two books we're talking about here are the general thrust of what we'll talk about. It's tied to these books. One is Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Rise of America's 1960s Counterculture, which was, I guess, published, what, in 2015?
Yeah.
Is that right?
2015.
And then the other one is brand new. It's 1968, The Rise and Fall of the New American Revolution. It's interesting. Cottrell's book on the counterculture includes an extensive look at the rag and the political scene during the 1960s in Austin, where he lived for several years, participated in the anti-war movement and draft counseling, and was one of the very, as he puts it, this is his words, was one of the very long-haired individuals who made up the city's counterculture. At one point, however briefly, he hawked copies of the rag. And when I was talking to Susie before the show, she said, "My uncle hawked copies of the rag." So it's the thread is long. Bob Cottrell grew up in San Antonio, graduated from the University of Texas at Austin, attended graduate school in Texas, California, and Oklahoma, and has been a professor of history and American studies at California State University, Chico, since 1984. He's traveled widely and taught in London, Puebla, Mexico, and Moscow. There's a good trio for you. Where he held the Fulbright Nikolay V. Sovichev?
Yeah.
Distinguished chair in U.S. history and American studies. Cottrell's special interest is reform and radicalism, with biographies of the iconoclastic journalist I.F. Stone, social gospel minister E. Nicholas Comfort of the Progressive Oklahoma School of Religion, and ACLU founder Roger Nash Baldwin. He also wrote a book on World War II conscientious objectors who served as smoke jumpers for the U.S. Forest Service, a dual biography of Hank Greenberg and Jackie Robinson focusing on anti-Semitism and racism in baseball, if any of you don't know that, and most recently, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, and The Rise and Fall of the New American Revolution, which was written with Blaine T. Brown. So, okay. Bob, welcome to Rag Radio.
Thank you. Nice introduction.
Well, thank you, especially since you basically wrote it. I tightened it up a little.
Yeah.
So, okay, but it's a great story. Your story is a great story. And it's
kind of the story of our generation.
So. Yeah, and it's one question I have before we actually get into the thing is that I'm 5 years older than you. You were born in 1950, right?
50, yeah.
I was born in 1945. I joined SDS in 1963 and was involved in SDS and the counterculture and the underground press and whatever from then on until now, it seems like.
Right.
I wonder, and I've asked this of other people too, I wonder how much difference that 5 years means in terms of when we came in and what our experience was.
I think the difference is enormous. I think that you are very much the exception. You can correct me if I'm mistaken about this. I think you were at the cutting edge. You were part of what Jack Newfield called a prophetic minority in his little book in 1965. SDS, as you well know, in the beginning, it started in 1960. It was a tiny, tiny organization. And then it didn't really grow all that much until years later. And it went through different permutations, Prairie Power, the new working class focus, the shift from resistance to, from reform to resistance, and then the calls for revolution. And I think that by the time we get to my generation, the latter part of the 1960s, there were those of us who were radicalized as we started college. We had people such as you to look up to, in a manner of speaking. But I also think there was kind of a distance, generationally speaking. And I may be mistaken about that, but I don't think so. So, yes, I think that there is kind of a chasm, as it were, between the different generations. And again, you can speak to this better than I, but my understanding is within SDS there were different divides and different generations. And in the beginning it seemed like they happened every 2 or 3 years, and then later it was like every 6 months or 6 weeks.
One thing that I think is important to understand is that SDS, of course, started out, you know, in Ann Arbor and on the East Coast,
right,
with graduate students and red diaper babies and what have you, and was a pretty academic group.
Yes.
But very quickly, SDS started spreading around the country, and what happened in various localities on the grassroots level was SDS was very different from what it was in the organizationally.
Mm-hmm. The national organization.
The national organization. And, you know, I was involved in Houston and Austin, although I was also, I went to all the national meetings and
mm-hmm.
whatever. But, it's also interesting, it's relevant here, is that these two books of yours, and one reason I really wanted to work with these two books is that one of the things you talk about is the parallel development, I guess, of the counterculture and of the radical left. My experience was that, and we need to interview you in a minute here.
It's fine. Yeah.
But my experience was that the counterculture was much more a part, SDS and the counterculture were much, there was less distance than there might have seemed nationally. On local grassroots levels, most of the people, like in Austin, most of the people who were in the left were also, to a great extent, in the counterculture, and in fact, that they revolutionized each other,
mm-hmm.
because we didn't call them hippies, freaks was what we called them.
Right.
But were their level, their sense of revolution was in some ways more complete transformation than was the political radicals, and I think they had effect on each other in that regard. So, anyway,
I completely agree with what you're indicating. That's one of the reasons why my book on the counterculture highlights what I consider to be the revolutionary aspects of it, and I also think that there was an affinity between the counterculture and the new left in particular, but that affinity was greater or lesser depending on which locality one was situated at and whether one was involved with a national entity or instrumentality. So I think a place like Austin, for some reason, and I suspect that you and the RAG were among those who had a great deal to do with this, with the shaping, the crafting of the movement and the counterculture both, in a place like Austin, there was that symbiosis, there was the natural affinity, the two were melded together. And I don't think that was always the case, if you're talking about across the country. I think it, again, depended upon where you were and the different individuals and the different groups that were engaged. Historians like to present this kind of divide between the left, the new left, and the counterculture. And as we're both indicating, that divide wasn't always there, but sometimes it was. And there were the politicos and groups like SDS that were not necessarily enthralled with the counterculture unfolding as it did. But Austin, for some reason, was just one of those stations, one of those spots that allowed for that melding process to take place. And it's very, very striking that even today, you know, when you talk to people around the country, and those who aren't in the know, they're still kind of taken aback by the idea of Austin having been this epicenter, which it clearly was. I mean, it was that for the counterculture. It was that for the new left.
It was a point of
order. It was that for the burgeoning women's movement, for the gay liberation movement. It was really a focal point. It was really a center.
I call it a point of origin.
Absolutely. And I think it's Kirkpatrick Sale, in his encyclopedic treatment of SDS, talks about that when prairie power began to spring forth in the mid-60s in Austin, among other places, that many of those who were drawn to SDS at that stage were even more radical than the founders.
Yes.
In part because where they came from, they weren't the red diaper babies. They weren't, you know, from the Jewish old left or that component of the old left that was, you know, had a disproportionate number of Jews participating in it. And the counterculture was something that was very attractive to prairie power participants, maybe in a larger fashion or to a greater percentage than would happen with others.
Yeah, that's true. The prairie power, Carl Davidson and
Gregory Calvert.
Greg Calvert, who, you know, lived in Austin for a long time.
Yes.
And in fact, Carol Neiman, who was when I was funnel of the rag, when we started the rag, we didn't want to call it editor because we wanted look for something less authoritarian sounding. So we called it funnel. And Carol Neiman was the funnella, and we were partners. And
I write about that in the book on the counterculture, and you are prominently displayed there.
Yeah.
In a couple of instances.
Yeah, you talk
a lot. The March on the Pentagon and
right. And
then the unfoldings in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, it's neat to pick up a book, you know, that you haven't read before and discover all of this stuff. But it's something that's happened more and more in recent times with histories of the left, which is what we did has gotten recognized more and more and more. And it's partly because in the beginnings of the new left and the counterculture in this country, most of the publicity defined what we knew about it, and the publicity, the media centers were on the coasts. And so it meant that there was a lot of stuff that people didn't really know about. For one thing, we had a major free speech movement in Austin,
the University
Freedom Movement, and it never gets talked about on the same level as Berkeley.
And it was also
Berkeley.
Connected as, I don't know if I heard you say this, but it was also connected with, you know, the sexual revolution as it was unfolding.
Yeah, I mean, we had, I think, maybe it was the first issue of the Rag or the second issue of the Rag, Gary Chasen had an article on the Sexual Freedom League at UT. And as has been pointed out to us later, that was very early.
absolutely.
Gay liberation and something. So,
I mean, again, events as they eventuated, unfolded in Austin, really were at the cutting edge in so many different manners pertaining to both the movement and the counterculture.
And you know that because you were actually here for a while.
So. Absolutely.
Hawking the rag.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a Joe Ely song that has, down on the rag reading, no, down on the drag reading want ads from the rag. That's our claim to, claim to fame.
But the drag, I understand, has gone through very different configurations.
Oh, a lot of things have.
I know.
In general, sure, but when the University of Freedom movement happened, you know, there was a whole week. Originally, we had General Thursday, and General Thursday was this radical. It was a radical event because what happened at the second General Thursday, it was actually outlawed by the university, and so it became a political act. You know, what was kind of a love-in and just a way to sort of break down barriers really became a political act, and it was massive.
I think that what you young men and women were able to do at that particular point in time took a tremendous fortitude. And, I mean, I grew up in Texas. I grew up in South Texas with all the machismo and, you know, the cowboys versus the surfers and, you know, those little battles that were playing out. And it could be perilous, you know, to be out there on a political or cultural limb, as I suspect that you were. I mean, as early as the rag was in place and as early as, you know, these events that we're talking about unfolded, it took a good bit of courage to participate.
Hey, Robert, this is Susie. I have a question.
So you're a younger one, right?
I am younger. I was born in 1970, so...
You're just a child.
Thank you. I was wondering about that specifically, the escalation maybe of the anger and violence that happened. You know, we kind of went into Kent State and there was violence on university.
Jackson State, yeah.
So what about, say, Antifa? When did they come up? When did, and do they have a place? Did they have a place then?
Antifa's interesting. I think I indicated this to Thorne. I'm working on a book right now on radicalism in the whole country, you know, American radicalism from the beginnings, with a larger focus on, you know, 1900 to the present. And there's a chapter at the end that deals with Antifa and other, you know, left of center organizations that are not as inclined as some were or still are to adhere to nonviolence and pacifism or anything of that sort. And Antifa actually, I think, has its origins in some earlier groups in the Midwest and elsewhere that originated in the mid-80s. And those groups were designed to prevent people of color, gays and others, from being vilified, not just verbally, but physically. And there was a readiness to kind of give back what one was on the receiving end of, instead of the idea of turning the other cheek. So, you know, Antifa is an interesting proposition. I have a daughter who's 25, and, you know, I explore some of these issues with her on occasion. And, yeah.
Do you feel like the younger generation has finally just said it, you know, peaceable ways, you know, it's hard to reach across the aisle to a bigot and meet them halfway, so maybe Antifa has a place?
I think that there's a percentage of young people in particular who have adopted that path, but again, the same thing happened in the 1960s, right, in the early 70s, when it was not the whole of the anti-war movement or all of the New Left or even all of SDS that went the way of going underground or joining Weathermen or anything of that sort. So I'm not trying to necessarily analogize then and today are Weathermen and Antifa, but my point is that it's a small group of individuals who are frustrated and who are committed. I think they're idealistic in their own fashion, just as many of those in Weathermen were idealistic. I hope that Antifa doesn't make some of the same mistakes.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Yeah. My sense of Weathermen, and you, the two of you and others out there may not be in agreement with this, is that Weathermen did pretty grievous damage to the left.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. We need to take a break. We're having so much fun that we're past our break time.
Okay, all right.
But we'll be right back.
Okay, thanks.
My guest is Robert Cottrell, and we're having fun. Tracy Schultz.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. The time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
All right, I'm Thorn Dreyer, and I'm back with you. Susie Sheeler is here. Tracy Schultz is our engineer. And Roger Baker is not here because we don't have anybody in the studio to take pictures of. But
For us.
We're here.
Except for us. We could be taking pictures of ourselves.
We're pretty good looking.
Yeah, we are. We're not bad. my guest today is Robert C. Cottrell, author of most recently, I think you're author, you've written about 20 books, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is not all, but is the author of two books that we're discussing the environment around these books. One is Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Rise of America's 1960s Counterculture, and 1968, The Rise and Fall of the New American Revolution. You were bringing up Weathermen. Why don't we talk about that for a minute, and then maybe we should talk a little bit about 1968.
Okay,
so,
sure.
What were you saying about Weathermen?
Well, you know, the question was posed about Antifa, and I was starting to make some comparisons, proper or not, regarding Weathermen, and then I said something to the effect that my sense is that Weathermen did, as I put it, grievous damage to the left, to the new left, and to the movement. And some of that was sort of in the nature of the beast. There were those who were going to associate the movement, the anti-war movement, the new left, with violence, with un-Americanism, even with terrorism, no matter what it or they did, the participants did. So some of that was just going to take place. And on the other hand, I think Weathermen tore apart SDS along with PL, Progressive Labor. So one moment you have a mass organization, a national organization, with hundreds of chapters across the country, large and small, with membership that was as high as 100,000, which is the top level that has ever really been reached by a left-wing group in this country. The Wobblies did it, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, back in the pre-World War I period and then during America's engagement in that conflagration, and then the CPUSA, the Communist Party of the United States, perhaps to reach that level, 1930s, and then again during the war. And SDS did likewise. And when SDS attained those numbers, the population was larger. So, you know, percentage-wise, it maybe wasn't as impressive, but it was still pretty darn impressive.
Also, I think that SDS had numbers way beyond its numbers, as it were.
Exactly, exactly.
It had impact
on so many
people. There
were lots of people who didn't join SDS. You know, later in the decade, if you showed up at a place like an SDS meeting in Austin, it clearly wouldn't have been what it was when you were first attending those meetings.
No, we had demonstrations with seven people.
Yeah, exactly. And some of those people were really pretty kooky, and some of them seemed to be like, you know, they were agent provocateurs or something. And yeah. And I'm sure that was.
We had a special section for the cops. So, no.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kidding. Yeah.
So, you know, you go from an organization that maybe reached that 100,000 member plateau, and then the next minute you've got Weathermen with 300 members and some affinity groups. I don't know. You know, I didn't go into math like my mother wanted me to, but I'm pretty good with numbers, and 100,000 does not equate to 300. So just on that level, it was kind of inane.
How many people started the Cuban Revolution?
Well,
No. I'm not. That was just
you,
a silly. That's a silly
that was
side
Cuba
comment.
In the 1950s,
that was not meant
was
to
the
be
United
a,
States, the richest country in the world.
Yeah.
Where if you were going to have a revolution, it was likely going to be a fascist one.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you, and I agree with essentially what you're saying about Weatherman. One thing we have to, and those were my friends, and some of them still are my friends.
Yeah.
Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn are close friends. One thing that we have to look at this in the context of was that once we got to 1968, it had been building, we were talking about an international, situation, we were looking at what was happening in the world and what the United States was doing around the world, and with the frustration that a lot of people had.
Absolutely, and I understand about the alienation and the frustration. On the other hand, I don't know how many hands there can be, you have a mass organization that was only continuing to burgeon, and you implode it. And so there wasn't anything of that sort, say, when Kent State and Jackson State took place, and even with the mass student strikes in the spring of 1970, there wasn't the kind of direction or leadership that might have existed otherwise. So I don't know. You know, the idea of bringing the war home, the idea of going underground, and, you know, the idea of planting devices in what was still a democratic society.
Well, there's questions about how democratic.
My side of the left, to be honest with you, was very much more in the kind of quasi-anarchistic, pacifistic vein. So some of this is...
Okay, I want to come in because I don't want to be... I don't want to create I was not supportive of Weathermen, and I agree with you that they did great damage to the movement. I have a friend, Alan Young from Liberation News Service, who's my other colleague, believes that they were absolutely and totally responsible for destroying SDS. I think it's not that simple. I think SDS was destroyed by a number of things, including COINTELPRO.
Absolutely.
And other forms of surveillance and infiltration there were assassinations.
And I think SDS probably grew too quickly. So
and it had no structure, and it wasn't built in a way to last.
Yeah. And like we were talking about earlier, it thrived. It seems to me, and you can speak to this again better than I, but it seems like it thrived best at the local level in a decentralized fashion. And when there was an attempt to centralize matters, then that didn't serve the organization or its membership well.
When I was back in Houston, pretty much, I was in New York, really, in 68. But then after that, I was in Houston. We did a paper called Space City. We just quit relating to the national, to what was happening nationally with SDS. But we still considered this, I mean, you know, the concept of participatory democracy and the basic tenets of SDS were still what moved us.
The basic tenets were phenomenally good, positive, like participatory democracy, community organizing, and so forth. You know, organizing against the war, engaging in draft resistance, even supporting, however inadequately, you know, the women's movement and women's liberation. Again, you know, you have a massive organization and then you don't. And I think it left a vacuum, a void for many young people.
Yeah. The end of
who
the
weren't able to participate or engage in a manner that they might have done had such an organization still existed. And unfortunately, it wasn't just SDS, it was SNCC. You know, SNCC had gone through its own transformations and had lost its early, you know, esprit de corps and the belief in the beloved community and so forth.
I would like to add, to just put in here for the people, there are people who listen to us, and I'm amazed these days to realize how little sense of history people have. And how many people I talk to who don't even know what SDS was, that I should tell people, if you don't know, that SDS was the Students for a Democratic Society, which was, it was an incredible force in this country. I think it was the largest student organization ever in this country. And SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was, actually, it was originally black and white. I mean, there were a lot of white kids who came in, and then as you move towards black power and even separation, it moved in that direction, and then the Black Panthers kind of arose. So, but anyway,
my one last point on this is one thing that I've found to be terribly unfortunate is, and this isn't wholly the case, but it is decidedly so. In contrast to the new right, which seated all of these young people who went into one Republican administration after another, I don't think that happened with a lot of new left veterans. It did, I know, at the local levels. And I do know there were people like Sam Brown, who was more with the student mob, who, you know, worked for Carter and so forth, and people like Tom Hayden, who, you know, became a California state legislator for two decades. Bobby Rush, you know, with the Panthers in the Chicago area and so forth. But you had so many more people who were connected with the new right who were able to go into these prominent positions at the national level than was the case with, you know, the new left veterans.
Well, that was partly because of attitude towards electoral politics, which was a little bit mixed, I think, on the,
yeah,
on the left.
I think there was some of that. And I think some of it was maybe the old red baiting and the left baiting. But, yeah, I think you're right. Some of it was by choice, and it wasn't necessarily the right choice.
No, I agree there too. To be skeptical of it was the right choice, but to avoid it was
definitely
not the right choice. So
to still be skeptical more than ever now.
right. Okay, let's take a leap.
Okay.
1968. You wrote a whole book about it. There have been many books written about it. Not as good as yours is. This is an excellent book. It's. I love. By the way, I had wanted to mention. Yeah, it's great. I had wanted to mention that of these two books. All right, about 1968, the rise and fall of the new American Revolution, it's written, the year 1968 has been written about many times before, but no one has covered it as comprehensively and as thoroughly as Cottrell and Brown. And then about the about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, well-researched and well-written, Robert C. Cottrell's Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll recounts the rise of the colorful hippies, the cults, the communes, and the conspiracies that transformed the culture of the Cold War. What's so interesting
That's
to me,
Jonah's, right?
both of those both of those quotes are from our dear friend Jonah Raskin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it's all gotta be good.
Nice blurbs.
Yeah, nice blurbs. Jonah, of course, has been on our show a number of times, has written for the Rag Blog, and comes to Austin and visits, and we all have a lot of fun. So.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. Okay, why was 1968 so significant?
It was a year when many matters came to a head. It was a year of tremendous possibilities and dashed hopes. It was a year of even millennial possibilities, and it was a year when it looked like the apocalypse was befalling the nation and good parts of the globe. The book 1968 focuses on the theme of a revolution, and so starts off with a look at, you know, the yippies, and it talks about the Boston Five, the resistance, the draft resistance movement, and goes through Ted and on, all the way to the denouement with Nixon's election and the wake of Chicago and the Democratic National Convention, which was such a debacle, and the terrible assassinations that took place. But it was a year when so much could have happened and did happen, and so much more of a positive, in a positive vein, could have taken place and didn't. It was the year when Dr. King was really trying to lead a new facet to his revolution, and he was gunned down. And it was the year that Bobby Kennedy was a participant and a leader in the New Politics, as it was called, an effort to revitalize and transform establishment politics. And Bobby was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, and he too was blown away. And with both King and Bobby being shot down, I think a lot of hopes and beliefs were as well. And I think that, you know, we were talking about, you know, shifting kind of to the hard left, and I think that was one of the spurs for certainly any number of people. It wasn't simply that, you know, you had a bunch of politicos and SDS or other organizations who decided to veer leftward. It was events, and like you said, the events were domestic, they were internal, and they were external, they were international in nature. It was a year when, you know, it opens with the Tet Offensive and the possibility of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army regulars prevailing in a final offensive, which didn't prove to be so final and didn't prove to be so successful, except that they altered American politics, the American political scene, and they gave lie to the notion that the war was going well and that there was light at the end of the tunnel, or that it could ever go well, it meaning the war. It was a year when the Black Panthers rose to the forefront. It was the year when John Carlos and Tommy Smith, the bronze and the gold medal recipients in the 200-meter dash at the Mexico City Olympics, raised their single gloved fist in a Black Power salute as the national anthem was being played at the awards ceremony. And that was an act of absolute dignity on the part of those two young men, and they were treated how they were kicked off the team and forced to return home.
Any current reverberations there?
Absolutely, yes.
Any parallels today?
I know that, well, I mean, I was just reading. I tend to check ESPN, like, constantly during the day, and because I'm a sports fanatic as well. And, you know, the president, whose name will not be indicated, mentioned,
because we would have
slammed
to have
Kaepernick
an exorcism.
And the NFL players who were kneeling, who are displaying the same kind of dignity and genuine patriotism that Tommy Smith and John Carlos did. They're the real heroes.
I don't understand
Not charlatans.
I don't understand how it's legal for him to come out and say that they should be fired. I mean, it.
Well, he can say it.
Well, but
well, yeah. I mean, I don't know about when you're saying legal. I mean, right. I mean, it has no legitimacy legally speaking. If that's what you're.
I guess. I mean, is it?
But when he's saying they can be fired for what they say.
No, he's saying they should be fired, and it just.
He's an idiot.
Well, yes, clearly. I'm just wondering. Yeah. It seems akin to. Well, I mean, for a president to, and I use that term loosely, to comment on private businesses seems very unseemly and borders on illegal to me. Is it not?
Not illegal.
I don't know about the word illegal. No. I mean, it's certainly unprincipled. It's undignified. It's dogmatic. You know, it's demagogic.
There is something
but
there.
But he can say anything he wants,
yeah.
Basically. Okay, well, wait, we need to stop, and we can come right back here. But we're sort of running behind on both of our breaks here, so we're going to be down to just a little over 10 minutes when we come back. Because we're having so much fun.
So much.
Okay.
I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and my guest is Bob Cottrell. And Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Take it away, Tracy Schultz.
Summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer. In the city, in the summer. In the city, cool town, meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop.
Okay, Tracy Schultz, who have we been listening to at our breaks?
Oh, that was a little bit of the Lovin' Spoonful, of course. And then right before that, we had Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah. You can't go wrong.
Never.
Yeah. So. Too good.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. My guest is Robert Cottrell, author of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Rise of America's 60s Counterculture, and 1968, The Rise and Fall of the New American Revolution. Okay, we need to move forward. We literally just have about 12 minutes left, so... I was going to bring some stuff up, but there might be things that you actually would like to talk about that we haven't touched on.
Can I just go back for one moment? You know, we were talking about weathermen, and not to fixate, but a number of the people who were engaged in weathermen were incredibly gifted and had a lot to offer, and a number of them have gone on and done really fine work. I just think as a collective body, Weatherman was a terrible mistake.
Well, you don't have any disagreement here.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right. All right. Well, back to my question, is there anything in particular in our few minutes here that you'd especially like to cover that, you know, I mean, maybe looking forward from 1960, ate, you know, what did it do? What did that, was there disillusionment after that? What did it lead to?
You know, looking forward. That's a really good question. I think that the year did not turn out like so many wanted it to, for some of the reasons we've already mentioned. And I think the results have been, in so many instances, in so many ways, corrosive. I don't think American politics have ever been the same. I think that Bobby Kennedy might well have been elected, and for all his flaws and faults, I think you know, the election of a Bobby Kennedy versus a Richard Nixon would have been enormously different. I don't know that you would have had all the progeny, the children of Nixon, all the presidencies, the Republican presidencies, with the possible exception of Forbes, but for what happened in 1968. And I don't think American liberalism has ever come back in the same heady manner that it had existed up until that year. And I think the left, you know, was assailing liberals and liberalism just as the right was. And I think that, you know, we on the left didn't necessarily end up with what we wanted or hoped would take place.
Well, we often didn't distinguish between the two strains, which I would call humanist liberalism and corporate liberalism.
No, absolutely not. And that was wrongheaded. And liberalism had a great deal to offer. Liberalism was also connected to some terrible mistakes and some, you know, structural inequities and failings. But, you know, it's sort of like throwing it all away, and then what are you left with?
Yeah.
But my point is, I think that American liberalism suffered a really severe blow. And, you know, American radicalism did. You know, you can sometimes look back and say, well, maybe 69 was a still more radical year, but it was different. You know, in 1970s, part of that year likewise. But there was something that was no longer present. You know, people always like to talk about, writers do, about, you know, innocence being lost. And I don't know when innocence was lost. I don't know in this country if innocence ever existed. But if it did, you know, the bullets, you know, to the heads of Bobby and Martin certainly didn't help.
No.
King's loss was enormous.
Especially since he had been
civil rights movement who were disenchanted with King, but he was radical to the core. And he was a believer not just in racial democracy, but in social economic democracy. And he was one of the most eloquent and embittered critics of the war.
You know, incidentally, when we talk about the question of liberalism and whatever, one of the differences we had, and I think it dated all the way back to, for me, the concept of progressive, of democracy as seen by SDS, mm-hmm. which was basically, bottom line, believed that the problems basically lie with the system, that the problems are systemic, that they can all be tied together, which bottom line meant you were talking socialism.
Absolutely. I mean, people didn't want to use that word for many years. Correct?
Participatory democracy is a word I couldn't, a term I couldn't think of a minute ago. you know, as much as this one. But yes, so I think that was the difference, was that basically what we thought of as liberals was that liberals had faith in the capitalistic system.
And that was the dividing point, right, in many regards, that and foreign policy. I agree with that. I think the problem is when SDS, SNCC, some other groups and individuals on, you know, connected with the movement began to speak more openly about support for resistance or even revolution and support for socialism, you had that leap forward, which was kind of curious, and there was this affinity for Marxism, and it wasn't just Marxism, it was Marxism-Leninism. And there was, you know, your friend Bernadine Dorn at the 68 convention, when she was asked if she were a socialist, responding she was a revolutionary communist.
Yeah, I know. And I think we were caught up in a lot of romantic stuff.
Yes.
Romantic internationalism.
Well, I mean, it was like, you know, Fidel was a hero and Che was a hero. And I mean, at my university door, the door that faces me when it's shut, the side that faces me when it's shut, I still have a poster of Che on it.
Right. I lost my Che poster somewhere along the
way.
Yeah,
well, it's all torn. It's all shredded, but it's there.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because we're still kind of thinking about that. It's like these ideas of what we like to remember some of these figures as versus like how they really are, and some of those terminology and it's like, and some of those, like, those feelings kind of get mingled a bit. It's like,
but I think so much of it was about the times.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Che is a perfect example, you know, a very romantic figure, this doctor who goes to become a revolutionary, and he's an incredible figure. And when I interviewed I.F. Stone in Washington many years ago, he reminded me of this piece that he had done on Che way back when. I think this was 1960, and he said Che was the most beautiful man he'd ever seen. And so there was that romantic quality, that allure. But Che was also, you know, a hardcore revolutionary. And Thorne, as you were saying, in Cuba, maybe that was absolutely necessary.
Well, yeah, I think actually it probably
but
was.
Again, the results, you know, Cuba, lots of positives, health care, education, but also authoritarianism.
Do you see that ever happening here, the uprising, the revolution happening here? And people just are, you know, it seems like for many, many years we've been fairly apathetic, and now we're coming up. You know, people are getting angry, but I don't really see a whole lot of them in the streets anymore. Right after
so
he got elected.
You're talking about people from the left, right?
Yes.
My fear is, again, what I said before, if there's a revolution in this country, it's going to be a revolution from the right. And people such as we are all...
Are you still there?
Yes.
We lost something there.
It clipped at the very end there.
People such as...
Yeah, now you're clicking in and out.
I am. Oh, my phone? Is my phone dying?
Yeah, probably.
We're getting close
that's
to the end.
That's part of our current social problems. My phone
yeah,
is dying.
Me,
I'm in
an outside library, believe it or not. And let me grab another.
Well, we have 1 minute before we have to go off. So
yes, before we lose you.
Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We need to, like I say, we have a minute, less than a minute. So what do you want to leave us with?
Well, I appreciate your engaging with me and talking about that era and my books, which grapple with a number of the key matters that were taking place in the 1960s and then in 1968 in particular.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for being with us, Bob Cottrell. It's been an illuminating hour, I think so. All right. I'm Thorne Dreyer. Alice Embry will be here next week with a show about immigration, and that should be interesting. I'll be here too. And so we want to thank everybody for being with us.